Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Nick Blumberg. Brandis Friedman has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at. An executive order massively shrinks the Department of Education. What the local consequences could be. And the Trump administration's efforts to ban transgender people from serving in the U.S. military. We hear from a former colonel in the trans community. And now to some of today's top stories. The Trump administration doubles down on efforts to fire probationary federal workers. The acting solicitor general earlier today filed an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking the justices to reverse a federal judge's order that the administration rehire some 16,000 employees across six agencies. The government says that amounts to a hijacking of federal authority. The judge who initially put a halt to the firing said the agency that handled the dismissals had no authority to do so. The case is one of several legal challenges to mass firings of federal workers. Chicago teachers and firefighters are coming together to press for new contracts.
We need a contract. We've been without a contract for 4 years. Back when the police finally got their contract, some of their contract issues went back to 2017. That's not acceptable. And then for the teachers now, they're coming up on a year. This is not acceptable. This is about unity, coming together, getting benefits.
Firefighters Local 2 Union President Pat Cleary says the staffing shortfalls the CTU has been focusing on mirror issues at firehouses. The solidarity rally came with the city and teachers union reportedly nearing a contract deal, with the CTU reiterating its calls for more prep time, more pay for veteran teachers, and overhauling the teacher evaluation system. No more editorials at the Chicago Sun-Times. The announcement comes after word last week that some 20% of the paper's staff agreed to take a buyout. Among the journalists departing are editorial page editor Lorraine Forte and board members Marlon Garcia and Thomas Frisbee. The paper had already stopped endorsing candidates due to restrictions on nonprofits after the Sun-Times was bought by Chicago Public Media. In a note to readers, CPM's chief content officer says while unsigned editorials from the paper are ending, the Sun-Times will still publish opinion pieces, columns, and letters to the editor. Up next, what a dismantling of the U.S. Education Department could mean for Illinois.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
President Donald Trump's push to dismantle the Department of Education is facing legal challenges. That comes just days after Trump signed an executive order directing his education secretary to, quote, take all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the department.
We're going to be returning education very simply back to the states where it belongs, and this is a very popular thing to do, but much more importantly, it's a common sense thing to do, and it's going to work.
But critics are pushing back on the president's move, including here in Illinois. In a statement, the Illinois Federation of Teachers says, quote, dismantling the Department of Education will destabilize working families and reward the rich and powerful at the expense of our students. Joining us to discuss all of this are Leota Scott, an associate professor in the College of Education at DePaul University, Peter Cunningham, former assistant secretary of education, and Paul Vallis, former Chicago Public Schools CEO. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us again on the program. So the Trump administration, as we mentioned, already facing legal action here. There's a suit from a coalition including the National Education Association and the NAACP. They say the president is going beyond his constitutional authority here. Leotis, just by way of background, can you remind us some of the functions that the Department of Education performs?
Well, one of the functions that the education performs is really just providing education for everyone. And so what is being proposed now is not a solution. It's just a series of setbacks with the cutoffs, the layoffs, and cutting of the budget and transferring all of the different programs to different departments adds to the problem. One of the takeaways, though, is it lets us think about education for everyone, which now we see that education also includes student loans, also includes health and nutritional values, but then also civil rights and rights related to Title I for elementary education all the way to Title IX for higher education.
Yeah, I want to get to some of those specific issues, but, you know, Peter, Trump says this move is giving education back to the states. I mean, in practical terms, what does this shift mean for school systems, say, here in Illinois?
Well, it doesn't mean very much, because the fact is states and districts control most of the funding for schools already. The federal government has a very small footprint. Basically, they just try and level up some funding for some vulnerable groups like students with disabilities, low-income kids, bilingual students, rural students. There's special funding pots for each of those different segments. And then, as Professor Scott was saying, they also do student loans. But giving it back to the states is a bit of a deceptive. And by the way, I'm not even sure he really means that. I mean, he already threatened the state of Maine to withhold funding if they didn't get rid of DEI programs. So I'm not convinced he really wants to give anything back to the states.
Do you think it's more of a bid for more control then?
I do think that he's trying to consolidate control, and he's especially in the higher ed section now, in the higher ed sector. He's definitely trying to control the money that's going to these schools that they depend on. You saw what happened at Columbia University, and I think that we're going to see a lot more of that.
You know, Paul Vallis, as folks have reported, the president doesn't have the power to completely eliminate the agency. But what do you think is motivating him to go after the department in this way?
Well, look, I assume that he wants to do what he says he wants to do. He wants to return primary responsibility to the states. You know, the Department of Education is really more or less a pass-through. For example, the student loan program, which incidentally I believe has been mismanaged. If you look at, obviously, who doesn't seem to be carrying student loans these days, could easily be done by Treasury. The grant programs can return to what was the successor of health, education, and welfare. And of course, when it comes to legal issues, I think the Justice Department can certainly pick up the responsibilities that the U.S. Department of Education had responsibilities for in terms of, you know, legal intervention and things like that when there is discrimination. So it's getting rid of the department, as I think Peter pointed out, does not necessarily get rid of the programs. That's going to be another issue. So he has said he's not going to be cutting these programs. We'll see what ultimately happens. But, you know, if you're really afraid of Trump and the fact that he has an agenda, he's going to advance that agenda, one would argue that if he keeps the U.S. Department of Education dominated by his people, then he's going to be able to advance his agenda. And he's been clear what his agenda is. He talks about school choice. He talks about the expansion of school choice. He talks about, reversing a lot of the legal issues that they were addressing in terms of DEI, things like that. So, you know, one might argue that with his appointees in the Department of Education, if he maintained that department, he could be even more aggressive to advance his agenda.
Well, and even if there are functions that you think could be, you know, handled by other agencies, departments, things like that, do you have any concerns about sort of the speed with which things are progressing here? You know, does it feel like this is moving too quickly a pace to be handled well?
You know, that's a very good question, and I think that's a very good point. They are moving fast on all fronts. Look, it took some real debate and discussion to create the U.S. Department of Education in the first place. As you know, it was not embraced wholeheartedly. For example, Califano, who was health, education, and welfare, not exactly a right-wing conservative, he was very critical in the Carter administration. He did not want to see a separate department. He felt it would encroach on local control. And then, of course, the head of the American Federation of Teachers was adamantly opposed, Shanker, very opposed. So at the end of the day, there is this issue. Are you moving too fast? And if you're not going to get rid of these programs, these agencies that take responsibility for these programs are going to need time to ramp up. So I think that's a very legitimate issue.
Leota Scott, you know, you mentioned some of the functions that this department performs. We've learned that special education services, nutrition programs will be absorbed by Health and Human Services. Do you have concerns about how, you know, students with disabilities or students who, you know, need those school lunches might be affected?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Paul said something that I think is not accurate around that these departments cannot handle the capacity. In fact, the SBA is going to be cut down by 40%, so they really won't have the capacity to do the student loans. I think about even to this year, it's been 240 years since President John Adams wrote his famous quote around education for the whole people. education for the whole people. And so we need to think about education for the whole people. That includes all the different health, all the different disabilities, and those who are disenfranchised. And so we have equality in that regard. And so the other departments don't really get the idea of what education means for the country, for democracy overall.
Yeah, look, you know, I have to respond to that if I can very quickly. First of all, agriculture, the school lunch program, isn't really the responsibility for the U.S. Department of Education. First of all, Treasury is the most appropriate place to handle the student loan program. The student loan program is a disaster. I think close to two-thirds of individuals who receive student loans end up not graduating from college. And the discrimination, the individuals that get impacted the most are women and blacks who simply are not graduating, and they're stuck with these student loans. So certainly there may be more appropriate agencies to manage these programs.
Sorry. I mean, I don't see any reason, though, why just moving things around is somehow going to make any of this stuff better. Okay? The issue is this. Is this a matter of national interest or not? Is education a matter of national interest? Every president has said so until Donald Trump comes along and says, we should be out of the business. And he's taking people out of some really important work to make sure that this country is strong and can compete globally. And there's plenty of evidence to show that we're falling behind.
Well, and, you know, to that point about the administration of the loan program, we learned that that portfolio is going to the Small Business Administration, which has also been hit by large-scale layoffs. I mean, do you have concerns about the size and complexity of that program?
Absolutely. And they don't actually handle those loans in-house. They work with banks. So they're going to take the student loan program, which was handled in-house at the Department of Education, and they're going to outsource it to banks, which is going to increase the cost of running it. And there's no reason to think that it's going to run any better. And I think that you have a lot of people who took a pause during the COVID era to payment. They're coming back in. There's going to be a lot of chaos. People are going to get lost. Things are going to get lost. And people will be denied access to college. And it'll be a whole, it'll be years before this thing settles down. And, you know, millions of people will be affected. So I think it's a disaster. And like so many other things he's doing, it's not done with forethought. It's just done with, you know, with haste and with, you know, no consideration for the people involved and what they're doing and who's going to be hurt.
Well, and, you know, we've been talking about, you know, attacks on, you know, universities largely related to, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion type initiatives. I mean, Paul Vallis, you've said that the Department of Education has long been sort of a political tool. Is that what's happening now with, you know,
going after
universities?
I mean, this is all political. Look, virtually every single president, I think with the exception of Clinton, and Riley have kind of advanced their agenda. Now, I'm not making a value judgment on what they advanced, but the fact remains that Bush, for example, I was superintendent under three different presidents, and I felt they were always interfering. Bush wanted us to privatize, use Title I money to give to private companies to do tutoring. The Obama administration advanced, you know, a standardized curriculum and testing. Certainly they had their agenda, and I'm not making a value judgment on that, but the Biden administration, you know, forget about the DEI issues, put them aside. But the Biden administration, when they got the Title I money or when they got the COVID money, relief money, they totally discriminated against private schools by only giving a fraction of what they were entitled to. So presidents do advance their agenda. And so they have advanced their agenda through the U.S. Department of Education.
I just want to be really clear. There is no control over the curriculum at the federal level, and it wasn't on the Obama administration. If anyone's trying to control the curriculum, it's the Trump administration now that is trying to rewrite history and tell people how to teach patriotic history, which means we're going to teach things like slavery from both sides. So they're the ones who are driving curriculum. They're the ones who are insisting that diversity, equity, inclusion is somehow a dirty word. So what's the opposite of diversity? Lack of diversity. What's the opposite of equity? Inequity? Yeah. Exclusion? Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, they're the ones with the agenda that's really, really, and it's hard to see them giving power back to the states in any meaningful way.
Yeah, and like I said, this is not a solution. If anything, going back to an agenda, there really should be about an agenda that progresses education. This is a persistent portrayal of democracy, using the power of democracy against its people. It's always supposed to be for the people. It goes back to 240 years ago, as President Adams said, education for the whole people.
We've got about 30 seconds left, but, you know, Peter Cunningham, you mentioned educational outcomes, which, you know, the U.S. has long lagged behind other developed nations. Could moving to dismantle the Education Department affect our ability to close that gap?
It certainly won't help. I mean, I don't see how one kid is going to learn to read from just moving these programs from one agency to another. If you want to really focus on helping kids learn to read, then support these programs. Give the states and districts the freedom and the power to do what they're doing, which they have for the most part, and make it a matter of national interest and let people know that we're going to be serious about driving education, about making a difference and helping kids learn. I don't see any of that coming from the Trump administration yet.
All right. Well, we could probably talk about this for the rest of the show, and I have a feeling we'll be doing so again in the future. But for now, Leota Scott, Peter Cunningham, Paul Vallis, thank you all for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you.
Up next, one-on-one with trans veteran and military advocate Jennifer Pritzker. A federal judge is blocking President Trump's attempt to ban transgender troops from serving in the military, saying the policy is discriminatory and, quote, soaked in animus. The move comes after current and would-be service trans service members, rather, filed suit over the Trump administration's executive order, calling it, quote, character assassination based on nothing. But administration officials want the judge to lift her injunction, arguing the ban has a grounding in medicine, not discrimination. Joining us now with more on this is Jennifer Pritzker, retired Lieutenant Colonel of the United States Army, as well as a businesswoman and philanthropist. In the interest of full disclosure, she is a supporter of both WTTW and our sister station, WFMT. Colonel Pritzker, welcome back to Chicago Tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So the Pentagon on Friday released new guidance on transgender military personnel, saying, quote, the Department of Defense will review service members' medical records and within 45 days give them self-assessment questionnaires to determine whether they have a current history, diagnosis, history, or symptoms of gender dysphoria. DOJ is arguing in court, as we mentioned, this means the ban is somehow based on a medical diagnosis, not an anti-trans agenda. What's your reaction to that?
Well, for starters, what questions do they propose to put on the questionnaire? What are they looking for? What is the criteria for either retention or discharge? And I think it's only fair that that be disclosed to the people who are taking the questionnaire. And I don't know why don't they just give that to everybody?
Right.
I know when I was in the Army on duty, we used to have health and welfare inspections. Been on both sides of them. That means they go through the barracks looking for contraband. And everybody in the armed forces gets drug tested. Everybody. The newest recruit, the most senior general or admiral. So I think they need to take a more even-handed approach on this issue.
Well, and, you know, backing up a little bit, what kind of an impact do you think a ban on trans people serving could have on the armed forces?
Well, it's going to be tremendous disruption. It's going to affect morale, discipline, unit cohesion, combat readiness, and enormously expensive for either no payout, no return on investment, or de minimis. Mm-hmm. For example, processing a civilian into any branch of the armed forces in the first year easily runs $100,000. Now that's just to, you know, create private snuffy.
Sure.
You know, because it's 6 months minimum, 4 to 6 months minimum of entry level training. And then when they show up for their unit, it takes another 3 to 6 months for them to become a net positive asset to their unit. So I tried to do some rough calculation. There's something like 5,000 to 15,000 transgender troops. And do the math on that. You come up with a number like 500 million just in loss of what was invested in year one. Now, when you extrapolate that to the cost of, say, a full colonel in the Space Force who's an aerospace engineer, you know, now you've spent millions on this person. And what is it about being transgender, provided they meet the standards for performance and qualification? What's the basis? So, for example, you know, getting through parachute school to be a qualified military parachutist. You got to do pull-ups and lots of push-ups. Because to control the parachute, you have to pull on risers. Those are straps that attach to the main canopy, and that's what controls you. And that can make the difference between whether you crash and burn on the drop zone and get carried away in an ambulance, or you land safely and walk away. So if you want people to parachute out of airplanes, one of the criteria is how many push-ups can they do? Right. How many pull-ups can they do? And along with a lot of other qualifications. And it's the same for, you know, all specialties in the military.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned the, mm-hmm. you know, sort of the expense that goes into mm-hmm. to training and yes. all that, you know, kind of being left on the table. There's also, you know, the argument from backers of the ban who say medical treatments for trans folks in the military are cost prohibitive. Do you think the numbers back that up?
No, they do not. First of all, you're dealing with a relatively small group of people. Also, a high percentage, I think it's something like 50%, do not require either any medical care or very slight medical care. So, you know, if somebody wants to see a psychiatrist, to discover where they are in terms of gender dysphoria, that really doesn't cost very much.
Right.
And if anything, the treatment, if properly applied, will save money in the long run. No organization is any better than the people in it. And if you invest productively in their welfare, you will have a better organization. But the numbers are just not there.
There was some polling from Gallup that showed mm-hmm. in 2019, 71% of U.S. adults favored openly trans men and women serving mm-hmm. in the military. It went down to 66% in 2021 and 58% this year. Why do you think that support might be declining?
Well, the current administration has made a massive, really obsessive effort to diminish the achievements of transgender people, to villainize them, to spread a lot of disinformation. And most people don't have the time or the energy, because they're busy making a living, to sort out, well, what's disinformation, what is information. And because there's so few transgender people, many people have never encountered such a person. One interesting number is they're estimated 134,000 transgender veterans. And it turns out that transgender people are twice as likely to serve in the armed forces than people who are not transgender. So it's just amazing, you know, the book bans, many other actions taken at all levels of government to really marginalize a transgender person.
We've got about 30 seconds left, okay. But, you know, I know in recent years the mm-hmm. military has sometimes struggled to meet its recruitment goals. Do you think something like this could make it harder for them to recruit?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think it will make recruiting. Recruiting's always been a challenge. Recruiting and retention. See, that's the other part of a volunteer force that people often overlook. Once you've signed somebody up, once you've got their enlistment out of them, in order to get the full return on investment, you need them to re-enlist. Well, that's where it's really going to affect. And this very ban is something that is going to be detrimental to the welfare and functioning of our armed forces. And I think it's terrible what's being done to our fellow citizens who have taken the time and the trouble and willingness to sacrifice themselves.
All right. Well, much more to say on this topic,
okay,
but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there for now. Jennifer Pritzker, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this Monday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and a special time, 10:30. One-on-One with Senator Tammy Duckworth on veteran layoffs, the local impact of federal funding cuts, and much more. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching, stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to give back to its community in Chicago and beyond.